Jaya Vishnupada Paramahansa Privratakacharya Svetarasita Shishumara Sivanga Shleisi Bhakti Vranta Sai Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki
Jaya
Iskan Founder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki
Jaya
Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki
Jaya
Nama Acharya Shri Haridas Thakur Ki
Jaya
Vensegaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gradhar Shri Vasari Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki
Jaya
Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Bhagavina Shyamakunda Radha Kaligiri Gaur Dhani Ki
Jaya
Shri Vrinda Dhavan Dhamaki, Shri Mayapur Dhamaki, Ganga Mayaki, Jamuna Mayaki, Bhakti Deviki, Tulasi Deviki, Samaveta Bhakti Vrindaki, Jai Gaur Premana, all glories to Sampradesis, all glories to Sampradesis, all glories to Sampradesis, all glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga, all glories to Shri in the sacred law. Okay. Okay, so this section and the origin of the sacred law. So now it's basically is that what are, here it says, the God-given duties of men. So then that becomes important. It means is that duties are God-given, not by someone else. We can't create them, we can't make them up, but they actually come from God. That's the system. Anything that's bona fide has come down through, in some way, from God down through Parampara. So whether it's in India, out of India, it has to have come in that line. Those lines last. Others don't. You know? You see the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Muhammad, the teachings of, you know, these persons. They last. You know, Buddha, these ones, they last. They don't go, they're called world religions. Other things come and go. You don't hear about them. Many people haven't even heard of other things, so people just make their own things up. And even what they make up, they take from those. They take something from Christianity, something from here, something from there, and create something. But it doesn't work like that. So they have to be given by God. So it's important to understand here that religion means how something functions. It means everything in God's creation has its own inherent religion or dharma or nature. Right? We have to broaden our understanding of religion, that it just doesn't mean a set of rituals that are done for, you know, the purpose of elevation. But it's how we deal with everything in the creation at every moment for the purpose of elevation. Right? It means we would look at it from present that we have to expand it, but what's happened is that the definition has become contracted. That everything in our life, that's our business, we're the doer, we get the result. But we do a few rituals here and there, and that's supposed to please God, so that in everything else that we do, we'll get a good result, even though it's not religious. Right? Does that make some sense? So the whole idea is that you're trying to establish that religion means how you deal with anything. So when the ritual means how you deal with those things that are, you know, more directly connected with God. You know, things that are directly for purification, the samskaras, methods of worship. These things then you see have what we call sacred rituals. But other things are not necessarily counted as sacred, but if they're done according to scripture, they give the same kind of benefit. It's indirect, but it gives the same kind of benefit. Right? So that means how you deal with anything, then that becomes a religious duty, because it's all based on the same principles of the sacred duties that are there in what we would generally classify as rituals. Right? The ritual is supposed to create humility. The ritual is supposed to create reverence. The ritual is supposed to create, you know, affection or tolerance or patience or all these good qualities. So then it should be that all those same qualities are there in everything that you do. So everything you're dealing with has to have that same quality. Otherwise, technically, it's not religious, because then you're going against the nature of what you're dealing with. Does that have some sense? So, that with that understanding, then we see is how these things are religion. Otherwise, Varnashram, you ask most devotees, they won't call it religion. You say, what's your religion? You know, it's chanting Hare Krishna. That's your eternal religion. That's dealing, that's the soul with God. But, you know, and your body, you're engaging in that. So that's there. But what are you doing with your body the rest of the time? Say, devotional service. Okay, so you're in the bathroom. What are you doing there that's devotional service? You're in bed. What are you doing in devotional service? You're out mowing your lawn. What's the devotional service there? You're out weeding your garden. Right? How to connect all that? How do you make that religion? So that's the whole point, is that why do you deal the way you deal? Like when you cook for Krishna, how do you cook? Just any old way? You know, put in, you know, 1 kilo of salt and half a kilo of cauliflower, and then you call that a religious offering? No, salt has its religion. It's to bring, enhance the flavor, not to destroy. So then you have to have the proper balance, proper proportion. Then it's religious. Does this make some sense? So in other words, how you deal with everything means there's a religion there. So there has to, and if you want to get a good result, means you follow the actual religion of the thing. Right? So you can't make it up. It's not due to our own sentiment. Somebody's a nasty person, then naturally that it'll invoke nastiness from us. But nastiness isn't necessarily the best way to deal with a nasty person. Right? Because then, what kind of nasty? Is it an intelligent nasty? Or is it just an emotional nasty? You know, is it based on ego? Is it based on intelligence? Or is it just based on sentiment? You know, is it based on the body, on the mind? What is the nature of that nastiness? Right? So if they're intelligent nasty, if you're more intelligent nasty, then they'll respect you. Then they won't be nasty to you. Then you're a friend. But if it's emotional nasty, then if you respond with pleasantness and kindness, then that, because it's emotional, they're doing it to get an emotional result, you're pleasant, that will So depending on what you're dealing with. You know, you have to identify what is the nastiness and what would be the best way of dealing with it, because it has a nature. You know, and depending upon what is your goal, you know, what level of religion do you want to act at? Because everything has its nature, but its nature for getting a karmakanda result, a jnanakanda result, or a bhakti result. Right? Karmakanda just has to be done according to the rules very strictly, then you'll get the natural fruit of result. Jnana means you deal with it with detachment, you don't even deal with it at all. And bhakti means is that you deal with it in the proper way with detachment to please Krishna. Right? So karma and bhakti will look very similar in activity, but in mentality, then jnana and bhakti will look very similar. The bhakti is different because it's both plus more. So that's why bhakti is complete. It's purna. The others are only part. Right? The spiritual world is purna. Material world is not. It's temporary. So unless the temporary is connected to the complete, it doesn't become complete. So karma on its own is not complete. It's a complete system, but it won't make the soul feel complete. Neither jnana. But bhakti will. Because bhakti includes already the proper attitude and with the proper activity. Does that make sense? So that's why then you're going to deal. So then what is the religion of man? What is the nature of man? There's eight aspects. Brahma, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas. So depending upon that combination, each one has its unique religion. So depending upon which combination you are choosing, then that will create that particular unique arrangement of religious activities. Right? It means its nature is unique, therefore the way to apply its nature is unique. But at the same time is, because it's the principle of what is human religion, therefore it's consistent. Right? When you add animal religion into it, it becomes inconsistent. Right? But if it's not, if it's human, then it's always consistent. Does this make some sense? So that's the whole idea, is that therefore God has created everything. So that means God knows the nature of everything, and He has inherently given the nature of everything to it. Does that make sense? So He's created all the species, and they all have their nature. You read in the history books of a dog, you know, thousands of years ago, and they're exactly the same as what the dog does today. And you can be assured that the dog will be doing the same thing tomorrow. Right? When they have futuristic, you know, projections, you know, into thousands of years in the future, the dogs still do the same thing. Right? People still eat, people still drink water, they still sleep. You know, they make some uniqueness about it, but it's just still the same thing. You know? So nothing changes, because God already made the nature. So then Varnashram is the God-given duties to man to fit their actual nature. So now it's a matter of, do you want to follow the religion of a human, or do you want to follow the religion of an animal? That's all. Now, just being religious isn't enough, because we're not actually just human. We're not humans. We're soul. So the religion of the soul is Sanatan Dharma, eternal service to Krishna. But we're conditioned, so we have the nature of humans, the religion of humans. So you have to combine the religion of humans, that it does not go against or supports the eternal religion of the soul. Therefore, Prabhupada says, Varnashram means you're human, but bhakti means you're a devotee. Right? Otherwise, you're going to have to act as an animal and try to engage that in devotional service. But the problem is, this animal means the lower modes. It means ignorance. So that means in ignorance, it's very hard to perform activities in a detached way. Does that make some sense? So that is the principle. Does this make some sense? Mm-hmm. So this is why then Varnashram is our religion on the mundane platform. And devotional service is our transcendental or eternal religion. So as long as we're conditioned, Varnashram is there. When we're not conditioned, we don't have to follow it. Unless you want to set example. Right? You simply have to follow the devotional principle. Right? Does that make some sense? So that's what it is. Therefore, it's God-given. That's the whole point.
So, the Varnashram system will look the same for a devotee or for a non-devotee?
Basically, as a religion, it will be the same. Though, the devotee will emphasize certain aspects and not emphasize others. Or, you have different levels on which you can manifest it. Right? You can cook just simply for yourself, or you can cook for a guest, or you can cook for a feast. So, but it's all cooking. It works on exactly the same principles, and it'll basically look the same. But it's just a matter of what is your goal. Therefore, you will use, you know, a lower, a higher level. So karma and karma yoga will look the same. And also someone who is performing pure bhakti, as a madhyama, it will also look the same. Difference will be consciousness. But there are certain areas that devotees don't have to worry about. if you're trying to keep yourself in the sphere of karma, you know, going to the heavenly planets and here, then you're working within a certain circle. You have the rain, right? You have faith, you have sacrifice, you have rain, you have grains, and you have semen. Right? That's the cycle of karma. You have faith, so you do sacrifice. From sacrifice, then you elevate yourself to the heavenly planets. From sacrifice, then there's rain. Right? That the soul, after it's finished its karma in the heavenly planets, falls in the rain. From rain, you get grains. Right? So then the living entity enters the grain. The grain is eaten by the person engaged in sacrifice. That creates semen. Semen is injected in the womb. You have a child. That child then is trained in faith. Does that make sense? So this is the cycle of karma. So therefore, they have to have a son. They have to worship the forefathers because they're in the heavenly planets. Unless you're keeping them there, you can't go there. So your father and your grandfather, you have to do Shraddha rites for. Right? You don't have to do for great-grandfather, but those two you have to do for. Like that. Otherwise, you cannot go to the heavenly planet. So, and if you don't leave a son, you can't go either. So if you're not doing for them, and you don't have a son to continue it for yourself, you can't go. So for them, having a son is so important. Performing their ritualistic activities that will get them to the heavenly planets is very important. So you will see then that particular aspect of the cycle is emphasized. Right? And because they're enjoying the facilities here, then they have to worship also, you know, man, all these different, you know, the persons in the house and stuff like that. So they have a debt to Brahman, they have debt to the gods, they have a debt to mankind, the forefathers, and I'm just reading it today.
Rishis?
No, the Rishis is Brahman. It's the same. Because there's two ways to explain it, and I always get the two mixed up. Because there's this three groups of the five. What you're killing, you have to purify yourself from that. But then those are done by these five things. And those five things then deal with these five who you owe the debts to at the same time, as then they also have a manifestation of how you do that. So it's...
The parents owe their debts.
Hmm?
The parents.
That's the forefathers.
Yeah.
Like that. So, funny, because I just looked at it today. Okay, so... So then they have that debt. But we will deal with the sages because we have the knowledge. We will deal with the worship of the Brahmins, and we will perform sacrifice. But the sacrifice means specifically the Yuga Dharma, not just the household sacrifices. But the others, the forefathers, we don't deal with, because for us the forefathers are the Acharyas, right? Like that. And we don't have to deal with the ghosts and all that, because we're, you know, worshipping Krishna, who's the Lord of the ghosts. You know? We don't, and sacrifice is not to the demigods, but it's to the Lord, because he's the Lord of the demigods. You know? But still, you know, the sages, meaning that we worship the spiritual master, that's taken care of. So
is the animals what? Animals?
They're taken care of in that all the other living entities. It may be the living entities in general. Maybe that's the... Because there's different ways you can explain it. You can also mean it as dependence. You know, feeding yourself. You have to feed yourself. Because if you don't feed yourself, then you're not going to be alive, so you can't do the other things. You can't worship the forefathers. You know, because you're one of the ones in the calculation of the forefathers. So there's different ways you can look at it, and it puts the emphasis in different places. So the devotee won't emphasize those, and will emphasize the sacrifice, you know, the chanting of the holy name, the worship of the devotees, and the study of the scriptures. Like that. So this is what they'll do. You know, by distributing prasadam, by preaching, then they benefit other people. Does that make some sense? So it will look the same, but they will do more on that side. So the yajñik brahmins and those things, you'll see it'll be more on that side. Someone who's not more into jnana, they'll see they'll do some other, they'll emphasize something else. But the basic principles are the same. It's like in Satyayuga, then the dharma is meditation. Right? The main dharma is meditation. That's the prominent. But that doesn't mean that they're not doing yajñas, that they're not doing worship in that yajñas, and they're not chanting any holy names in the form of mantras. But the emphasis is the meditation. To perfect the meditation, the other three are done. In Treta, then yajña is the point of perfection, but there's meditation on the deity, there's worship of the deities, and there's chanting of mantras. Right? But all that is to support the sacrifice. Then the Dvapara, then the worship of the deity is the prominent. But to do that, there's meditation on the deity, sacrifice for the deity, and chanting the names of the deity. When the Kali Yuga, then the chanting the holy names is the prominent, and that meditation, worship, and sacrifice then are to support that. Does that make sense? So in the same way as those who follow the Vedic culture, then the principle is all the same, but it's just which one is the main and which ones are supporting. So for the Karmakandi, then the elements that are actually underlying in bhakti and jnana are there, but they're only underlying. So the result they get is only karma. And if they're following jnana, there's some elements of karma there and some of the elements of the bhakti. But because karma is their goal, that's their purpose, what they think they are a jnani, therefore they get the result of jnana, which is only detachment. They don't get bhakti. And the devotee, because they're performing the activity in understanding and knowledge and remembrance of the Lord, therefore then they get bhakti. Does that make some sense? So that's the point, is that it's all there because it's a complete thing. Krishna, the cosmic creation, is complete. Therefore everything in it is complete. But depending on which you emphasize, that comes out more. There is spontaneity in Vaikuntha. But it's spontaneity within application of the rules. Right? And in Vrindavan, there are rules, but they're only there to create a form for the spontaneity. Does that make some sense? You know, it's not Mother Yashoda, you know, decides to, you know, put a pot on her head and dance around, you know, for Krishna or something. You know, it just doesn't work like that. You know, cowherd boys might do that, but she won't do that. You know, does that make some sense? So, rasa has a path. It has a nature, because it also has a religion. So, rasa has its particular rasa has its own religion. So, they follow that religion. So, the path is spontaneity. Rasa and spontaneity, then the spontaneity that is the prominent taste, though it still has its path, it follows the path. But the path of rules and regulations, the taste is well done rules and regulations. You feel satisfied that you have done your best in the proper way. So that gives a taste. But there's that spontaneous that you want to serve through the rules. So when you hear, you know, Ramanuja, you know, speak, you know, on the higher levels of their bhakti, you see there is a spontaneous aspect, but it's still within the framework of rules and regulations. You know, spontaneous simply means you have an attraction to do it. You like following the rules and regulations. Understand? Spontaneous devotional service is defined as following the rules and performing devotional activities because you have that natural attraction for them. Right? Like this. Vaidhi is following because of the rules and regulations. It's what should be done. Right? But that doesn't mean that you can't come to the point where having a spontaneous attraction to performing the scriptural rules properly. Right? It's not intellectual anymore, it's actually the taste. But that will send you to Vaikuntha. Right? Does that make some sense? Yes? No? Yeah? Okay. So, therefore, we see is whichever one is emphasized, that's what you call it. It's not completely separate little squares, you know, like on a computer diagram. It's all overlapping, right? It's just, is it just like it's going on and, you know, it's bright light out and the sun's out and then suddenly, bang, it's pitch black, you know, the sun just went out? No. There's a gap in between. Even if you just turn the light off suddenly, it doesn't go immediately. There's a fraction of a moment where it goes between light and dark. There's always a junction. There's no such thing as exactly this and exactly that. It means you deal in tattvas, you basically kind of do like that so that it makes it clear exactly what you're dealing with. But when you apply it, then they overlap. That's why so much detail is there, is when it's in the middle, it's easy, but when it starts getting towards the edge, then the one thing looks like the next. You know? You know what I'm saying? So, just like in an astrological chart, as the planet moves closer to the edge of the sign, or the house, it starts to take on the qualities of the next house or sign. And the things in the next house or sign have some of the qualities of the one before it. So you have to know that, how one thing merges into the next and transforms into each one. Then you understand what is the principles that's working on it. Otherwise, then you just know that there's this and there's that. Okay, that's very nice. Okay, what is he? Well, he's got a crown on and he's got some armor and he's got a big sword and a mustache and it looks like you wouldn't want to mess with him, you know? I would think he's a Kshatriya. You know, bingo, okay, haribo, you know, vacation in Tahiti, okay, so, you know, so like that. But it's not so simple, because the actual thing is the subtle body. The varna and the ashram is the subtle body, not the gross. The gross matches it. All right? Does that make some sense? It means you had a kid, right? Baby. Baby completely doesn't know what's going on, doesn't relate to anything. All it knows is that it wants to eat. It doesn't have any conception on what happens after eating when it comes out the other end. Right? So therefore, you know, anytime it wants, it just goes anywhere and all that. So therefore, you dress that body according to its subtle body. Right? As soon as you train that subtle body that, hey, you know, we got things, such a thing as a toilet, then the dress changes. Right? You know, one could say, no, they just mature. But you have people who are, you know, have mental illnesses. And they may be in their 20s, 30s, 40s. But they still dress them like a baby. Does that make some sense? So, therefore, the external marks of the varnas and ashrams are based on the subtle body. Does that make some sense? So that's why then all the rules are there. But the first thing to get in place is the mentality. So generally when we talk varnashram and we start the mentality, it's kind of like, hey, you know, what about, you know, what are we supposed to do? You know, how are we going to make money? How are we going to do this? That? No, that's second. First you have to have the mentality. If you have the right mentality, then you can do all your duties. So those things have to be in place first. So therefore, God-given duties. Right? So here, Brahman is assigned teaching and studying the Vedas. The Kshatriya commanded to protect the people. The Vaishya to tend cattle, trade, lend money, and cultivate land. The Shudra to serve without resentment. The other three. So one is the mood of service, humble service. One is the mood of creating economics, you know, in a religious way. The other is protection. The other is studying and teaching. That's the mentalities that have to be there. Right? Because it's gaining that knowledge, distributing that knowledge, protecting the people. So because you're protecting, you need resources, so then you take taxes. Right? Because he teaches, he knows he can teach. Because he teaches, then he can receive charity. Because he protects, he can take tax. right? Because he endeavored to create economics, therefore he can receive the result of that economics. Right? But he has to give in charity that. Right? And the Shudra, because he's dependent, he has to serve. He can't create economics, he can't protect, and he can't teach. Right? Because he doesn't have that. Maybe teach an art, but it's not his field. His interest is not to understand the goal of life as his occupation. As his personal interest, yes, but let's say he's into music or painting or drama. Those are going to be prominent in his mind. So he could teach that to someone else. Right? But philosophy and all that, that's not what he's thinking about all day. The Brahmin is. So, depending upon the mentality, the Kshatriya is thinking how to protect the people. And to protect them, then there needs to be proper economics, there needs to be proper arts, there needs to be proper knowledge, there needs to be that. So the Brahmins have to be in place, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, and his whole administration, to do that protection. Right? Vaishya is only going to gain money if he performs sacrifice. He needs Brahmins, so he gives charity to Brahmins, and he gets sacrifice, and he gets money. Right? He'll only be able to and do his economic thing if he has Shudras to help him. So therefore he has to take care of them. Right? The Kshatriya, he has to run an administration, so he has to have Shudras to help him. So he has to take care of them. Right? Some of the Brahmins to do their Brahminical activities, some of them they need Shudras, so then they have to take care of them. Right? So the mentality then actually creates what is the need. And then that need creates the particular duties. Does that make some sense? So that's just going on. Now then it mentions the Brahminical order then is for the purpose of maintaining the law. Studying the law, practicing the law, teaching the law. Therefore the Brahmin is the essence of the law. So therefore they're respected by everybody in this system because they're the ones who give that law and see that it's going properly. The Kshatriyas then are respected because they actually create the facility that the law can be practiced and correct anybody who is improperly practicing. Right? Then the Vaishyas are next down because then they create the economics by which that law can be practiced. And the Shudras that are next down from that, because they are the create the you know the mobile I mean the you know the human force behind it that all the details can get done. And then below that is just considered, you know, outside Varnashram. If they can't do any of those four, then they're considered lower. So Shudra means the common person. It doesn't mean low class, it just means the common man. Right? And then, of the common men, some can create economics, some can create protection, and some can create education. Does that make sense? Generally, we tend to start at Brahmins, and then it goes low class down. No, they're the ones, and then it's going up. And then of Brahmins, then one who is realized in the Vedic knowledge and understands actual Brahman, then that's higher. And who's understood Brahman is the Lord, he's the highest. Does that make sense? So it keeps going up like that. Because when you walk on the street, you're seeing the common person, right? You're not necessarily seeing the guys that are running the businesses. You're not seeing the guys that actually run the government. And there's a good chance you're not necessarily seeing the teachers and the professors or the doctors or lawyers. So what are you seeing? You're just a common person. Does that make some sense? So, but that's human life. Human life means you start with this. The Shudra mentality. Shudra is a human being. And if one's not following the occupation of a Shudra properly, one's below human being. Like that. So generally, in a non-Vedic society, what you see on the street is lower than Shudra. They may be performing the occupational duties of a Shudra, but their mentality is actually lower. Does this make some sense? Okay, so therefore...
How can we understand or see that like a lot of devotees who have come from not even being Shudra, but having the highest interest, trying to understand the Brahman as the Lord?
Mm-hmm.
Where does that kind of fit into?
Because the soul is separate. Because what we'll learn later is that by mental offenses or mental sin, then one takes a low birth. So even though someone may have been very elevated, but because of impure thought, then they can take birth in low-grade families.
But that's still keep that.
Yeah, so the inherent nature is there. If you can purify away that aspect, then naturally they'll come back to wherever they were. Plus, you have the element that the soul is naturally a servant of God, means one who knows Brahman, so that means automatically, technically, the soul is a Brahman. Mm-hmm. But you have to see then what the conditioned nature is that soul is shining through. And then they'll take up the occupation accordingly. You know, what is the actual taste of the mind? What rasa is the taste? Just like in the spiritual world, what is the taste of the soul? You know, what particular rasa, then they manifest that particular form. So in the material world, what is their particular taste within the material world? If it's religious, then it's, you know, human. If it's not religious, then it'll be subhuman. And if it's even lower than that, then it'll be within the animal species. So that makes some sense. So it's a taste of what it is as you find is a taste. So then that you'll be born in that situation, because that's your subtle body. Your subtle body will naturally just be attracted to the gross situation.
It says that you know, when you take up devotional service, you're already going through all these sacrifices and pious activities and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I see where I come from, you know, my parents and the society, and it's nothing elevated about it, huh?
No, but it's certainly what we're saying is due to mental offenses, then one takes birth in these families.
So can I conclude that that's because I have committed some mental offenses?
That's one thing one can conclude, which particular ones, or on top of that, there can be verbal and physical offenses. But the result of low-class contemplation and thinking is low birth.
But is that the only way you get low birth?
No.
Just be low and low birth?
Yeah, that can be. But then what we're talking about here is, in connection to his question, how somebody who's taken a low birth comes in contact with Krishna consciousness and then suddenly is elevated up to these very not common platforms.
But you know, if someone comes in contact, that means that he must have done this before, or there is...
That's there also. But I'm just saying, within that, is that you have, you know, you can have the devotee, if they think all kinds of low-class things, that's where they keep their head, then there's a chance that they'll be born in lower-grade families. If they haven't performed much... See, when we say perform devotional service, see, is when it's conscious that it's devotional service, that it's an endeavor, then you call it devotional service. If you're not conscious of it, though you've done it, you call it sukriti. So... the guy who, you know, sees the Hare Krishnas and, you know, likes them and likes their food, you know, likes to come around and, you know, take part in a few kirtans, that's all sukriti. It's bhakti sukriti. So it will be counted, it will go in your book under bhakti. So that means you had to have done something. It is devotional service, but you don't know it. So therefore, it goes on what you know. Just like you perform an activity, you're not the doer, the result's not yours. So technically you have nothing to do with it, just desire. But because you think you have something to do with it, that you did do it, therefore the reaction comes to you and it means something to you. So you're either elated or, you know, not so elated with the result. Does that make some sense? So because you don't see it as bhakti, it is bhakti, but you only get the sukriti of it. But when you decide, hey, you know, you want to commit yourself to this, then it turns into bhakti. So when there's enough of that sukriti, then the faith rises to the point where it actually switches into bhakti. It becomes conscious. Therefore, it's called shraddha, faith. I have faith in this process. Even though you've been doing devotional service, you've been, you know, performing activities of Vajana Kriya, you know, you may regularly go to the Sunday feast, you have a taste for the halava, you know, you have an attraction for it that you can't live without it, you know, you go into ecstasy when you eat so much of it, you know, like that, but it doesn't mean that you're on those platforms. You know, you're associating with devotees, you have faith that if I eat enough halava, I'll be really happy. You know, so, you know, basically you can get 8 out of, you may even really love the halava, you know, so I mean you can get, you know, all the 9 levels out of it. Right? But it's still just sukriti until you become conscious of it. And so where your consciousness is mainly fixed, that's the stage that you're considered at.
Within that. And say 5% of the population are brahminical qualities. So what's about the devotees? Should only 5% of the devotees take Brahmana initiation, or all of them?
No, because that's general populace. That's human society.
So all of them should take second initiation?
That means if they have the nature that they're actually going to use it, and if not, no. Prabhupada said everybody doesn't have to take second. Because unless they're going to use it for doing puja and for increasing their meditation, you know, that kind of aspect, unless they're going to use it for cultivating the mode of goodness, then there's no need.
Some people say it's necessary for chanting.
It's not. Holy name is separate. It's above all this. So means the mantras you get from chanting, unless there is the mode of goodness there, they won't work. So how do you take someone in ignorance and give them those mantras and they'll get any benefit? No. But the holy name doesn't care for initiation. It works. But the devotional process needs commitment. Therefore, initiation is the method of confirming commitment by the conditioned soul. And through that process, then one becomes purified. This is the authorized method. Because it's authorized, then the chit potency will work. Right? So the holy name is independent. So therefore, just by chanting, one will be elevated. There's not a... So that's what's so unique. That's why in this age, only the chanting can work. Because all the other processes, your meditation, your sacrifice, your deity worship, and all their mantras, require the mode of goodness to make operate them. That's why even the big Vaishya king is doing a great sacrifice. He still has Brahmins to do it because they're in the mode of goodness. So he'll get the result. And the result goes to them. The king is the sponsor for the Ashwamedha Yajna. The Brahmins do that Yajna. The result of that Yajna goes to the Brahmins because they did it. The king gives dakshin to the Brahmins. Then that result is transferred to him. It doesn't automatically come. It only comes when he gives the dakshin. So that's the point. So therefore, even the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas in the system depend upon the Brahmins for their elevation. Because it's through the knowledge they gain from the Brahmins, it's by the sacrifice of the Brahmins. The example, then they get elevated. At the same time is the Brahmins couldn't function unless there was a kingdom that was protected that they can function within. And you wouldn't have a kingdom unless there was the money that the Vaishyas did. And you wouldn't have the economics and all these other things unless the Shudras were helping. So therefore each helps the other. But you have to know the order. You know, the whole body is important. But it's like you can lose your feet, you can lose your arms, you can lose your legs. You can take out, you know, half of your organs and you still function. But if you take out your head, then that's it, you're finished. You know, so that is, so therefore, then it's seen in that way. Right? Yes.
If one performs devotion service in ignorance, so what kind of sukriti he gets?
I mean, it's just bhakti sukriti. It depends upon whether he's performing devotional service. It means if he's ignorant of devotional service, he gets bhakti sukriti. But if he's performing bhakti mixed with ignorance, then the result is very slow, because generally that's offensive. Because he'll be very proud of his background, his education, his position. You know? So therefore he'll figure anybody that doesn't have that quality he has is lower than them. You know, I'm older, I'm wiser, I'm that. I don't want somebody half my age telling me what to do or judging me for one thing I say. That's devotional service in the mode of ignorance.
I've heard even if one does such devotional service, or very elevated activity, with such ignorant mentality, so it's better not to do it at all, because such activity becomes, you know,
Yeah, but the point is but that approach, that point is there, but now what's the next point you want to make after saying that? Having said that, now what will you say? Yeah, so then what should you do? You know what I'm saying? You have to be very careful in applying that, because devotees will bring down other devotees that you shouldn't do that, but they're not talking about what you actually should be doing. The point is progression. You should be doing it in a pure frame of mind. Therefore, this is the actual mentality. This is the actual way to do it. But you don't always hear that. No, you shouldn't do it like that. And that's the mode of ignorance. So they just destroy. You know, so that's of no benefit either.
Trying to invent water with tap water with the baby.
Yeah, you just throw everything out. So that is the point, is devotional service has a process, and that is what has to be performed. What is actually good? You know? So these things are pointed out because they're obstacles. But the point is devotional service is more powerful than the obstacles. So if simply devotional service is relied upon, then all good fortune will come. But the other is the mode of ignorance, because ignorance means everything's finished. It's lamentation. So then, therefore, what to do? You know, and there's no hope, and there's no, and everybody's like that. And so all we can do is move out of the temple and get into sense gratification, be independent, make our money, do whatever we want, and nobody can follow, so why should we follow? Right? Does that make some sense? So that mentality, I saw one zone, one of the most powerful zones in the world, disappear in 3 weeks with this mentality. 3 weeks, it evaporated from being the top zone in the movement to being not even existing because of this ignorance. Because they weren't careful to cultivate humility. They were very proud of their position, that they were superior to all other zones in the world because of their prowess. Because of that ignorance, then when things went down, then immediately then it's like, hey, you know, position, and you know, but what's the use of my position? What am I getting out of it? I'm not getting any sense gratification out of it. So then, bang, out the door. Well, I've seen other zones in the same thing, and they just kept going, you know, the way they were going for years. Right? And then slowly started to go down a little bit.
Is that principle applied for any group? Is there devotees or like any personalists who practice?
Yeah, you can apply, because all principles come from devotional service. So you can take the same thing and give a lecture on business management, or how to run a country, or how to run your household, or how to cook your lunch, or how to clean your toilet bowl. It's all the same principle. You know? If there's not focus, if there's not endeavor, and there's not, you know, the good result of your previous activities, you're not going to get your toilet cleaned. And it's not going to happen. So you go into a bathroom and it's got a sparkling toilet, it's because the person who cleaned it had those three things working for them. Does that make sense? like that. You can change the names, give it different, you know, nice sounding terms. You know, from focus is concentration, or, you know, you can come up with all kinds. That's what these professional orators and business, you know, management orate, business gurus do, is they just come up with great sounding titles for these same three things. Because that's how the world works.
Which three things? Which three things?
Focus, endeavor, proper endeavor, you know, and karma. Means even you have focus and endeavor, but unless you have the karma to get the result, you won't get it anyway. So the people that have the money, they have the focus and know what is the proper endeavor. Therefore, they have it. And the ones that don't have the money, don't have the focus, and don't know what the proper endeavor is. Or they have one and not the other. And a few then buy the books, read all the things, do all the things, and don't get it. You know, or some know what it is, make the endeavor, but they have to start the businesses five times. The fifth time it works, you know, when he's in his, you know, late 30s, and then finally it clicks, you know, or 40s, and finally it happens. Because he knows what to do. He has the focus. He knows what's the proper endeavor. He has the faith in it, so he's, therefore he's focused. He has the desire for the result, so therefore he endeavors. But he doesn't have the karma, but he just keeps trying again and again and again. So that's the Vedic cultures, you have those three. You just endeavor. But instead of doing it because you want the result, do it because it's your duty to do it. Then, depending upon your karma, you'll get a result or not. So therefore, don't be attached, whatever you get. Whatever you get, be satisfied. If you get a little bit, that's all you're supposed to get. Because if you put in all the things, that's all you're supposed to get. You know, so by endeavoring more, you won't get more. So what is your defined amount of endeavor? That much you should do, and not more than that. Otherwise, then you reduce other aspects of your religious nature. You know, that the soul has to be taken care of. That requires sadhana, that requires sadhusanga. So if you put in more than 8 hours a day on your economic development, then you're taking away from the time of those other necessary things. Because some people go to the office an hour a day, 2 hours a day, and they make millions. Others go, you know, 12 hours a day, 16 hours a day, they don't make millions. So it's not time. You know? It means you always have to see, you have to look, is the focus proper? Is the knowledge of what they're doing proper? Are they doing it right? You know, they actually know what they're dealing with and how it functions. If those two are right and they're still not getting a result, then you understand it's just their karma not to get. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't continue doing their duty. But they shouldn't go beyond and do it more. They should just know, continue with that, and that's all you're going to get anyway. Does that make some sense? But, you know, people don't want to hear that you're only going to get so much. They want to have the idea, I could make millions. You could. Everybody could be a millionaire by following these principles. But only those who have the karma to be a millionaire will be. And the others won't. And probably in the process, the one that's guaranteed to become the millionaire is the guy who's writing the books and giving the lectures. And if they were destined to be millionaires anyway, they would already inherently have that knowledge and focus and would be millionaires. So you don't find one millionaire sitting in that guy's lecture or reading that guy's book. So you can pretty much guarantee that the guys that are millionaires are already millionaires. The guy that figured out how they became millionaires and figured out how to teach that to everyone else, he's a millionaire. But the guys that read the books and go to his lectures never become millionaires. That's there. And one devotee was telling me, because before being a became a devotee, he used to go to those kind of things. And then one day after the lecture, he stayed until the whole auditorium cleared out, you know, because everybody goes up and talks and this and that, and thank you very much, you know, very inspiring, and all these kind of things. And then finally, after everyone had left, And the guy who gave the lecture was just putting his last papers in, folding up his briefcase, and he walked down. He said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Now you're giving these lectures to all these people." He says, "What's the reality of anyone here in this audience actually being able to apply it and to become so successful like you talk about, like these successful people?" And he just, the guy kind of looked at him, you know, because he could understand that he was, you know, the devotee was pretty thoughtful and observant, kind of real. He says, actually, if they had the ability, the potential to be millionaires, they already would be. He says, the people that don't have it, they're the ones who come here. So he said, you know, no one in this audience will become millionaires. But it makes them feel good. It inspires them. It reduces their anxiety and all that. So therefore, you know that. Plus, it lines the guy's pocket. Yeah, you know. But that's his point, is the reason that they want it, it makes them feel good, even though they can't apply it. But it makes them feel good. Yeah, now I know how to do it. You know, and make more plans, get together with the friends. Yeah, you know, yeah. You know, like this, and still nothing happens. But at least then there's less anxiety. So that's the point. So that's the whole thing, is you can take these things. Because they're just the essence of what is human nature. So what makes money, what makes administration, what makes teaching, what makes service, that is the Varnashram system. Just the West is unscientific. Some people observe it, make notes of it, you know. Like you have these business gurus, or you have Machiavelli, you know, or you have Sun Tzu, or different people like this. They make these observations on what makes it work. Do you know that the stock market that goes on now, that all the economics were run, the Romans used to run? Their economics was based on the stock market.
Goes back to the Romans.
Yeah, in Europe. And this system of stock market that the Japanese do, they study the stock market by what's called candles. It's a way of where the market opens and where it closes. Where if it closes higher than it closed, opened, or lower than it is, what's the distance, you know, and certain things, it makes a certain candle of a certain size and a certain color. Right? It means it opened, you know, one way and another. You know, it just kept going. If it opened at one thing, it's going up. And then it closed higher than that, then it leaves an opening. If it opened at one and it went down below that, then it makes a dark one. It changed direction. So then they study those patterns. And they're some of the most successful at the stock market. This candles, its history goes back to the 1600s to one man who used to notice the selling of rice. So the stock according to the rice. So the stock market goes back to that time. So it's always been there. You know, but it's not the Vedic thing. That's the Vedic thing, means it's in hard cash. You got something of value, you trade it for something of value. And what is that value? Then the king has to establish. It says every, you know, 5-6 days or a fortnight, the king's, you know, whoever it is, the minister, the officer in charge, has to establish the market rate. Because if there's more of it, then it has to go down. If there's less of it, then it goes up. You know, because people pay more, then they have to let it go up, but not much up. Otherwise, the business fees will take it way up and stuff like that. So the king has to see that the up and down in the market is, you know, proper.
They keep it very fair.
Yeah, keep it very fair. They have to see that their weights and measures are always, every 6 months, they have to check all the weights and measures of all the business people. So all these things go on. But the point is that was real, but this thing of unreal, that's been around a long time. People just think it's a new thing. No, you know, it's old. It goes back, you know, thousands of years. Whenever people leave the Vedic culture, then the bourgeois figures out how to take advantage. You can create a stock, means that before it was stocks of things that was actually there. Now you can trade in something that doesn't even exist. You can buy a commodity 3 months from now that doesn't even exist at a certain rate and then sell it for more than that when it actually comes up.
Well, before it.
Yeah, or even before. You can sell it to someone else. You know, you can take anything. I saw one is that somebody started a new stock on celebrities. You know, so it's how much is going to be their popularity and stuff like that. And so people buy and sell on. All it is you have to create something that people will buy and sell on. That's
just a huge gambling league.
That's all it is. Like that. If you know the systems, then it becomes more of a science. So it's not really gambling.
You're going to see the pattern.
Yeah, but most people don't follow that. You know, so therefore it's just sentiment. That's how it works. It's just people's moods. You know, some calamity comes and certain items just go up because everybody wants it, and certain items that are luxury no one wants. So just the sentiment of the people moves it up and down. And then because people don't know is that everybody's buying, hey, the stock's going up, hey, let's get into it, and by the time they all go into it, then it goes. It goes, how do you say, it just keeps going more and more and more. But then at some point it goes up too much and nobody wants to pay the price. So then everybody stops buying. So it just drops. Then when it's dropped really low, then it's dropped low so no one will touch it. And then it sits there for a while and then slowly, slowly starts up again. And then, you know, then a few buy and a few more buy and a few more buy and it gets in it. And, you know, that's all. It's just people's, you know, attraction to it. So people who know the patterns of that, then they study that and they know at this point if you buy, you sell here before it goes like that. And then guys that are even more smart is they know how to buy on the way down. They can make money when the stock market is crashing. You know? That's the really good guys know that. So everybody else, because the point is if someone's losing money, someone's gaining it. Because it's the same amount of money. So all it is if you know the science of how the money works, you know, the dharma of money and people's value of it, means this illusory money, if you know the science of it, then you make money whether it's going up or down. It doesn't matter. Because you know if it's this way, you do it like this, and if it's that way, you do it like that. You know, it's like, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter, you know. You have a frying pan and it's not so great, you have a spatula, you flip your pancake. You know, if this doesn't stick, you know, you just flip it without the pancake. It doesn't matter. You have a spatula, don't have a spatula, you can flip your pancake. And someone who doesn't know how to flip a pancake, even with a spatula, can't do it. You know, so it doesn't matter. So that's the whole point, is it's just, you know the science, it works. So the Vedic principle is, what is the real thing that it works on that actually everybody, because it should be everybody is progressive. When your whole society is progressing, not that just a few people are and other people are losing. So that's the problem. The bourgeois will simply take it, if they make money and everybody else loses, they don't care. That's why they have to be religious. They have to give to the Brahmins, they have to pay taxes to the Kshatriyas, and they have to take care of the Shudras. Then it's progressive. They don't want to take care of the Shudras. So they want to get more and more Shudras that pay less and less and have less and less responsibility. So that way they get more and more profit. But you can only, how much you can actually fully take care of, that much you can expand. Your business can only maintain 10 Shudras. Nicely, that's all the bigger it can be. But they figure out ways that I can keep 100 Shudras.
And machines?
Yeah, the machines, and then you get rid of all the Shudras, and then you have to... Then you have to pay extra money for your security because those Shudras have no jobs and they steal from you. You know, then you got to pay, instead of paying money to the Brahmins, you know, like that, you pay to the poor people because you're not hiring them. So then all the money gets put in the run, and then Brahmins have no security, so no one wants to be a teacher. And so then the education just plummets. You know, so it's crazy. So that's why everybody has to be controlled by one. There has to be a standard for everybody, and everyone has to be controlled by the Kshatriyas. And the Kshatriyas' control has to be based on the knowledge of the scriptures given by the Brahmins. Otherwise, everybody would go nuts. Okay.
It's talking about endeavor, what we've talked about before. The balance between over-endeavor and, mm-hmm. like, laziness, or is that Is that duty?
Yeah, because it's duty is proper endeavor. You know, this is what you're supposed to do. You do that, then you get your, then it's proper. You will fit nicely in. You know, if it's over endeavor, under endeavor, there's going to be some problem fitting in.
How many hours per day can you do the economic work?
Economic work for yourself, 8 hours. Because you're going to sleep so many hours, you got to eat, you got to take your bath. You know, the people are actually endeavoring for economics for themselves, then are householders. So therefore, then they have to give time to their family. I mean, how many, what is, I mean, it's a very typical scenario that there's a guy out making huge bucks, but he's never at home, and his family is distraught, and it falls apart. The kids go crazy, and the wife is frustrated, and ends up in divorce, and it's a very popular theme. You know, no movie is made out of the poor guy working his, you know, butt off down at the, you know, at the docks or something like that, you know, 16 hours a day and his family falling apart. No, it's always the lawyer, the doctor, the CEO, it's been like that.
Eight hours maximum.
That's a problem I mentioned. You might have emergencies sometimes, but it should be as you plan it as 8. I mean, Prabhupada mentions that somewhere. I'm not sure if it's a letter or a purport, but I came across it. Because devotees always ask, and I didn't know what to say. And one day, either someone saw it and came across it and gave it to me, or something. But Prabhupada mentioned 8 hours.
But that Brahmins, they can beg.
They can beg, but they won't beg for 8 hours. Because there's a limit there. They can beg at 7 houses. Okay. You know, so whatever they get from 7 houses... then that's how much they get.
Choose the right house.
Yeah. That's there. But even which houses you can go to are also mentioned.
Right.
You know? So like that. So everything has its nature. You know, it means it can't be someone sinful. It means if there's no pious people, then of course you go to whoever. But if there is, then you always pick the pious, because bad occupation is bad money, and money carries karma. So you beg, you take on karma. Anything for free, you take on karma with it, karma or consciousness, or both. So then, yeah. So that is, yeah. And then there's also, even of those who perform the activities, there's those who, you know, it'll come across all this, those who keep a store for a year, or up to 3 years, but otherwise the Brahmins, then it mentions a year, or it can be 6 months, or 3 months, or 3 days, or only one day. So that means if he's taken a vow of only collecting as much as will be for that day, then if the first house gives him that much, he won't beg anymore. Or he'll beg from the 7 houses, keep enough for the one, and give the other the rest away. Because he also is supposed to be given charity. Like that. Or if he knows every day he has so many guests, then he collects for that and then gives the charity away that way. But some way or another, he also. So then, you know, everything has its regulated. Okay. You know, the kshatriya also can only take up to so much tax. Okay. Because that's knowing what is the nature of the thing and what is the profit you gain off of it. So that's the whole thing. That's also a whole science, is knowing how to fix the taxes and duties. Like that. Duties that come into the kingdom, or, you know, move in the kingdom, he can take a duty on. Like that. But the duties are small. Certain items more, certain less. And then taxes then can be done on a certain thing, what profit you make. So that way then, you know, so between duties, taxes, and fines, then the government's maintained. But even a fine, certain fines the government does not use. There's a special treasury that is just for fines that are from the mortal sins. Killing Brahmins, stealing from Brahmins, illicit sex,
captivity.
Yeah, these kind of things. Those who are liable to those fines, those are kept in the special treasury that are either given to elevated Brahmins, not even ordinary Brahmins, or it's thrown into the water and offered to Varuna.
Because his money is contaminated?
Yeah, because it carries the sin. Because by taking tax, he gets sin. That's why it said, that's how Alabandaru, he won the debate. That was Yamunacharya. He came, and he was 8 or 12, young boy. He came to the kingdom like that. I'm not sure what was the inspiration for coming, but in any case, he came. And because he's a young kid, no one wants to, see him, that he will, he just treat with him like a kid. To get the king's attention, he came walking down the road when the king was going out on a royal procession. And, he's a Brahmin, he came, with one of his friends. So he came with a Brahmin. So then, naturally, they're not going to disturb him because the royal procession is all kinds of things. So they'll stop there, and there'll be somebody in the front who's managing and all these managers. So they come and say, the king's coming, you should move out of the way. Right? Because the only thing the king has to move for is a snataka. But, on these occasions, even a snataka will move because it's the king's procession. It's there for inspiring the people and all that. So he knows that that's important. If it's just the king and a snataka, the king will move out of the way.
What's a snataka?
Snataka means a Brahmin who has basically, who's graduated, who's educated. Like that. Like that. That means someone who will become a grihastha. An Upakurvana Brahmachari, when he graduates, then he's called a snataka. If he doesn't graduate, then he's a Naistika Brahmachari. But they're respected of that. In other words, when they finish their education, then they're respected. To that degree, they're educated. To that degree, they're respected. So he stopped on the road and says, no, the roads belong to the Brahmins. He says, if the king wants to pass, he's got to take my permission. Not that I have to move for him. And they say, hey, come on, you little kid, like this. And he starts quoting Shastra, and he says, okay, like that. And then, they go and this and that, and then I think the prime minister comes, still won't budge. So the king has to come and say, hey, we're doing this thing. He says, I don't mind you moving, but I have something to ask of you. You have to fulfill that. Then I'll have to. So he asked what it was. He says, I want to debate with your head Brahmin. Like that. Because otherwise, they'd never allow him. So then the king agreed, and he moved out of the way, had his possession. So all this gets back. This gets around real fast, So then the queen heard about this kid, and she said, here's the kid that's going to defeat this Brahmin. So then when he walked into the court, I think then the queen just seen him, said, this Brahmin's finished. The court Brahmin. And the king said to him, wait, you have to see. You have to let him speak first. Don't just like that. So then they sat down for the debate, and then the court Brahmin, because he's an elderly gentleman, so he says, it's natural, it's because whoever asks the questions is at advantage. So he says, because you're such a young boy, and he's such a senior to him. So out of, deference, he will let him ask the questions, because you don't expect much question out of a little kid. So then the kid said, okay, my question is this, prove three things wrong by Shastra. Prove that, and he points at the Brahmin, that your mother is barren. Barren means didn't have a child. Prove that the queen is unchaste. And?
What was the thing?
Something about the king.
Yeah, the king.
He's not the...
Oh, yeah, and prove that the king is sinful. And the Brahmin says, I'm going to prove I'm sitting here, so that means, you know, my mother's not barren. How can I say that the queen's unchaste, and how can I say the king's sinful? So then, you know, then the queen immediately, when he asked the question, she said, you know, he's one. The king, hey, sit down. Like that. And then he's talking the whole crowd because he can't answer. So then the Brahmin says, well, okay, we could consider that, you know, the point is this defeat means that it's answerable questions. So as far as I see, he's just asked questions. This is just what you call jalpa. Jalpa means you just talk things that make no sense, just to deflect and just break down the thing to just disturb the other thing. It's one of the techniques of nyaya. You know, so then he said, first let us see him answer them. If he can answer them, then I accept defeat, because, you know, if he can't answer them, how can I be defeated? Then it's my turn to ask questions. So then he said, the first thing is because you're the only son. And unless a woman has two children, because if one dies, then she'll be without children. So she's considered, according to Shastra, barren until she has two. That's why, at least in South, they have the principle of Sumangali. Sumangali is a woman who has two children. Like that. Then, but according to the scripture, you only have to have one. You're obliged to have one child. It doesn't matter. The wife is technically called barren. You've had your son. Your debt to the forefathers is filled. The second child is lust. The first one is duty. But the principle is on the woman's side, she's considered like that with two. Then, he said, and then the queen... Because before she was accepted in marriage, when you went to the fire and you accepted her hand, then you chanted the mantra that she is coming from the moon to Gandharva, Gandharva to Agni, and Agni to you. That means she's already been with three men before she got to you. And only on them leaving her body, in other words, she's been touched by them. You know, a woman who's touched by another man is considered unchaste. She's already been touched by three men before you even touched her. And the king, because he takes taxes from the sixth of the prophets of the people, therefore he takes on 1/6 of their karma. So the king automatically has 1/6 of the karma of the kingdom. That makes him the most sinful man in the kingdom. So, yeah. So then when he said that, then the queen again jumped up. And then she said, Alabandhu. Which means, I think, he is one or something like that. So that's where he got the name, Alabandhu. So that's Yuvacharya. Ramanuja's guru. So that principle is the king is because of that, is sinful. Therefore, Brahmins, unless they're in times of distress, don't accept gifts from the king. Because anything they take from the king means they take on heavy sin. But if they have no money, then they'll go to kings. They can, if they want to continue their brahminical duties and not give them up and take up kshatriya vaishya duties, then they can beg from kings, you know, or from people, impious people, or these kind of things.
I just want to understand this about the low mentality, and what does that mean? You know, you have low mentality, you get a low birth. Does it mean that you?
It means contemplation of sinful activities. You know, sinful activities or sinful qualities. You know, envy, malice, lust, greed, attachment. These kind of things. That this is the contemplation. So that means the subtle body is absorbed in that. That means naturally you should have a gross body that matches that mentality. So low birth is there because those are the qualities of those who are unpurified. So in other words, unpurified thoughts, you know, then will create an unpurified body. Because what Gita says is that the body is created by what the mind is. How the mind is, then you get a nose, ear, like that. So depending on what you want to see, smell, taste, touch, then that's what kind of gross body you get.
When we said that if someone comes in contact with devotional service, that means that previously he had done all the yajnas, he attained impersonal Brahman. That means that he achieved the Brahma-Bhuta platform.
No, Brahma-Bhuta, you can say, but see, the point is the scriptures talk about it, but can you name one person in history from the scriptures who actually attained to the Brahman?
No.
That's the point. It's only talked about. Whether anyone actually attains it, I don't know that it's possible.
It's kind of like that you become happy by material life. Also, it's just talking about.
Yeah, it means you go to the heavenly planets, you'll enjoy, it's deathless. Is it?
Oh, okay. So
you understand? Like yeah, it's just illusory. But because it is actually part of the path, you know, of liberation, so therefore it's the aspect of that you can get liberated isn't what's put down. And so what's put down is that stopping at liberation, that's useless because it still won't satisfy the soul. The soul won't be satisfied until you come to this to transcendental relationship on the spiritual planets with the Lord and His devotees. So that is the real definition of liberation. So us means we're liberated from material existence and situated in devotion in the transcendental platform. So it's rasa. When you're liberated from material rasa and endeavor and you're situated in spiritual rasa, that's real liberation. But if you're liberated from material rasa and you don't attain spiritual rasa, then you're not actually liberated because the soul is ananda. So ananda means rasa. Sat means relationship. Chit means activity. So that means he's not actually liberated because he's out of the material world, but he's not actually out because how do you say? He hasn't gotten to anywhere where that sat, chit, ananda can be addressed. He's only dealing with sat. And that's even impersonal, not even relationship, just that he exists. He's only dealing with half of the relationship. He's there. He's not filling out as God is also there. Sat means God is there and his energies are there. So we're just taking it energies and we're just taking it as us and it's not even defined. It's just all one. So it's not complete. You can't sit there. So it's not actual liberation. So even if somebody got there, how long will they stay there? How long could you stay in a room alone with absolutely nothing going on? No furniture, no nothing. Just either it's just the whole thing's all white and super bright and that's it, there's no form or act, or it's pitch black. These are your two alternatives.
Yeah, but my question was...
You know what I'm saying? How long can you stay? So even if someone did get there, how long could you stay in a room like that? How many minutes, how many hours? You know what I'm saying? Even if you had the most distressful situation and all that and just wanted to get away from everything and you got put in that room, then it's for a few months you go, all that's gone. And then when all that fades away and your happiness, then it's kind of like, well, this is pretty boring. And then you'll think of the good activities that you liked. So at that moment, you're back in the material world. So you're dealing on eternal time up there. So for you, it's only a few moments, you know, maybe a few lifetimes of Brahma. But for the experience of soul, it's nothing. So if somebody attains liberation for a few minutes or a few hours, do you actually call that liberating? When they come back again into... So therefore, one is anyone getting actually out you don't hear of. And those those getting out you don't hear of. And even if they did, theoretically, how long would they be out? So they're back in, so you can't really call them either. So we only hear of two people who are actually attained that platform. And both of them are devotees. The four Kumaras and Sukadeva Goswami. Sukadeva Goswami's brother, Mr. Harit. You know, so he performs that pastime. The four Kumaras are an incarnation of Godhead. So, but other than them, you hear about ones who are impersonalists, but you never hear that they're liberated.
It's sorry, Mark, I don't remember the name of the rishi. It was Anhira or something, not Anhira, but something with Agni also. And he was mentioned that he was actually a liberated sage. And when that lady came, then he became attracted to her breasts. He didn't even know that the breasts, he just saw that, oh, beautiful person.
No, that's Rishi Shringa.
No, that's a story, another story, like that she had the breast and was covered with a veil, and he couldn't even know, he didn't even know what it is, but he was going, can I help you carry those things, they're very beautiful and attractive. And then he became attracted to the woman, and he fell down from that liberated platform. I'm not reading this story.
Oh, okay. But he's still within this body, so he was on that platform. Yeah, you know, you don't hear leaving, one or two you hear demons going there. Dhritarashtra said attained impersonalism.
And then Bhagavad Gita Krishna said, so that's a karma at this moment. A verse of attained perfection.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like.
Yeah, I'm just saying, but then it falls back. So, but you don't really hear many names. So they aren't that prominent. It means that theoretically it could be done. So even if in one universe one person does it, there's unlimited universes, so that means unlimited people are doing it, but it's not like worth mentioning.
But the thing the Bible says is it's just in the mind that they're liberated.
Yeah. Basically it's that. They're liberated, but it's in the mind. They're not attracted and all this, but actually leaving the body. You hear Dhritarashtra here? The demons definitely get liberated. That you hear.
But isn't that because we kind of just read the devotional scriptures?
No.
I mean, what is there the Upanishads talk about it? Vedas talk about it. Vedanta Sutra talks about it. Gita, Puranas. I'm just saying, what's that other scripture? We understand the Vedic literature through, when you say devotional scripture, for us, Vedanta Sutra is devotional. Gita is devotional. But for the impersonalists, those are their scriptures and they call them not devotional. The Karmis also read Gita. They'll call it their Shastra. So it's just a matter of Mimamsa, how you interpret what is there. Like that. But because otherwise all the six schools are based on the Veda. Like that. So it's a matter of your interpretation. My point is that you don't really hear of anybody. You hear of people who are on that liberated platform while they're in the body, but you don't hear of many that leaving the body and attaining Brahman. You know? And even if of those who do, we know it's temporary anyway. It means you tell them it's temporary.
Srila Prabhupada talks about that they always come down and they become they take up humanitarian worlds or something like that because lack of taste. So then
so they come back as very elevated, pure people.
Because they're bored.
Yeah, but that's not their first birth.
Yeah.
Prabhupada in Hong Kong was on a morning walk there. And he said, you know, he asked, what's the first birth? You know, I mean, and when yogis, I mean, when these impersonalists fall, says they take birth as stones and trees because they have no movement, no this, no that, because their thing is everything's Brahman, it's all one. So they become immovable living entities. That's the first birth.
What about liberation and liberation?
That's what we said. Maybe is there. It means, what's your point of your question?
I mean,
what I'm saying, did you connect that to what we said before?
As far as I remember, Shrimad
Bhagavatam. Yeah, it said there. That's what we said.
Okay.
Some may.
Oh.
But if they do, they don't stay.
Hmm.
Like that. But that was only by the grace of the pure devotee that he got that.
Hmm.
Anyway, because Vidura instructed him. So that's the point, is that
before we were discussing the tattva and it's like this grey areas. So what about the Vishnu tattva and the Jiva tattva? Is it a grey area?
Means you could look, one is Shiva, that could be a grey area, that's in between. He's servant. But he's not God, but he's still Purusha. You know? Like that. So he has both the qualities. Means you have the other Vishnumurtis is that they are the personality of Godhead,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead, at the same time they're also servant of Godhead. From Balaram, every expansion of Krishna except for, I think, what was it? Vilas? Or no, Prakash. Prakash is where he exactly as he is expands, like he dances with the gopis. That was Prakash.
Right.
That's him.
Yeah.
But Vilas means he's not, he's also Ashrad. Prakash means he is only Vishai, enjoyer. So he is simply the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bas. But as soon as he expands into Prakash, then he is Supreme Personality of Godhead, plus he is Ashray. He is a servant of Krishna. That's why Balaram is also called the Supreme Personality of Servant of Godhead. Like that. Because he's the Supreme out of all the Servant of Godheads. Because from him expands all the other Vishnumurtis. So that also could be said something in between. Then you have, in between, you have the Shakti, the Surup Shakti. And so then expanding from there is us. So like that, you have so many aspects of which way you can put. Does that make some sense? So then that brings us down to, yeah, so that'll bring us to the...
Discourse 2?
Yeah, because then basically now this ends the, I mean, where his like whole intro of this. Now at this point he actually describes the 25 topics of the law, what they are. And then after that, then in Discourse 2, then today is what? Wednesday. So on Friday... Then we'll discuss the desire for results, though we kind of touched on it today, and the source of the sacred law. Like that. And then we'll go into the ashram dharma, the sacrament. So, yeah, familiarize yourself with that. Okay. Is that okay?
Mm.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivedanta ki, Janita Govardhana ki.